Hi, this is David Vaughn, Worldwide Product Marketing Manager at IBM. I'd like to welcome you to the first in a series of podcasts that are part of our celebration of 50 years of innovation in disk systems. IBM introduced the first disk system, the IBM 350 Disk Storage Unit, which is part of the RAMAC 305 computer system in September 1956. The 350 Disk Storage Unit was 5 feet wide and over 5 feet tall and stored 5 million characters of information, which is roughly equivalent to 5 megabytes in today's terms. We're lucky to have two people on the podcast today that were involved with the 350 Disk Storage Unit. Al Hoagland was an engineer on the IBM development team, and Jim Porter worked for the company that received the first system. Al and Jim, thank you for joining us today. Now, let's start with Al. Al, the 350 was developed in San Jose, California, long before that region was known as the Silicon Valley. Tell us about why your group was located in San Jose and what mission you were given.
IBM came to the conclusion that they were unable to really attract a lot of highly talented people from the West Coast to the East Coast, and it was necessary they set up a laboratory on the West Coast to get these kind of people. It was recognized no ability to really manage it as another engineering activity, so it was a small lab under the guidance that they'd only hire new people from that area, and that they would work on advanced technology, which is possible with such a laboratory. Now, the reason it ended up physically in San Jose is that the talents on the West Coast tended to be centered at that time in the aerospace industry between Los Angeles and Seattle, so they wanted somewhere in between. San Jose sort of fits that, but more importantly is next to a city called Campbell, which had a card processing plant, and the fact that could provide administrative support to this new laboratory is why they physically placed it in San Jose.
Well, okay, thank you, Al. So when this group was formed that eventually developed this storage unit, what mission was given to the team?
Essentially, it's all keyed to Ray Johnson. He was an inventor, highly oriented to problem solving, and his track record is such that they gave him a number of areas to look into to eventually lead to some justification for the laboratory. But he was the kind of guy that looked around to see what kinds of real significant things maybe he could do there. And in communicating and talking to people that primarily in this area were at that time being punch card users, had a lot of difficulties points in time getting data they wanted because they'd have to go through long sort routines or other procedures to find the data. So he began to see an opportunity if he could come up with a storage device that could provide 4 to 5 megabytes or millions of characters of storage that could be accessed in less than a second, really would be a great value to these customers. And being an inventor, he looked to see what he could do to address that problem. So in one sense, he's the kind of guy that when he sees a problem and recognizes, he looks to see what he can do to address it. And this was pretty much because of his track record, he could freewheel in San Jose.
Okay. Now, when you decided to go down this path of trying to come up with a way to retrieve information very quickly, was the magnetic disk the obvious choice, or were there other choices that you considered?
There was no obvious choice. I think basically he almost took a full year looking at all sorts of conceivable ways to economically get a very large capacity for that point in time with a very short access time. He looked at wires and tape strips and everything else. But gradually, he began to focus on a disk stack, and February of 53 is when he finally edicted that from now on, they were going to proceed on the basis of using a dense stack of magnetic disks. Now, the technical argument for the approach is to get the capacity, you want a lot of recording area. To get the access time, you want it in a fairly small volume. And if you have a disk stack, particularly if they're closely spaced, you can get more capacity in a small volume within, except for something where you couldn't get direct access to any surface. So it was a choice which sort of provided a way to get under a second to any record in the unit and get this capacity, and the disk stack required 50 disks in a 20-inch stack to provide the 5 million characters, but a lot of the competitors were looking at doing that with drums, which would take much, much more volume. So it was a departure from what any other laboratory was looking at, and there's a lot of skepticism even among his own people as to whether you could really do this, because Ray, again, in problem solving, didn't spend a great deal of time worrying about fundamental research. He worried about what could he do to make something happen that he saw possible.
Well, that's really interesting. Now, there must have been a couple technical challenges as you were developing the disk system. Could you talk about one or two of them to give us an idea of some of the hurdles you faced early on?
Well, I think obviously just using a disk stack, thin disk that large, spinning them 1,200 RPM, was a real challenge to see whether that in fact would work. Now, just spinning disk isn't enough. You had to say, we've got to coat them magnetically so we can actually record on both surfaces, and that had to be worked through too. And of course, that disk stack has been a standard perception now of disk drives ever since. The other major challenge is you have to keep the head that's reading the data, or writing it in fact, off the disk. They're going very fast, and you can't afford to have a spacing that would lead to a crash. Worse, that spacing has to be controlled very tightly so you can reach your objective of getting the densities on all the disks. And they came up with a pressurized air-bearing head at that time, which could work with disks that had a great deal of flutter, and successfully showed they could maintain the spacing between the head and disk. And the head, of course, was quite small because, unlike normal tape heads, it was fitting in a very small separation between the disk. So that was the other major challenge. And then the third would have been the mechanisms to move the head arm assembly up and down and in and out. That used some techniques, but you wouldn't have even got into that if you hadn't convinced yourself you could, one, get coated discs that would be spaced quite close together, and two, able to control the spacing of a head off those discs at a spacing which allowed the kind of densities you needed.
Thanks a lot, Al. That's really interesting. That's incredible to think about 50 discs and stack them up for 5 feet tall. Now let's turn to Jim. And Jim, you were involved with the company that got the actual first unit of the RAMAC with the disk storage unit. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became involved in it?
Well, actually, when I got out of the Army after the Korean War in 1955, I actually went back to San Jose to work, where I'd gone to college, and wasn't even aware of this IDM activity only a few blocks away from where I was working. But it didn't take me long to decide that San Jose was a terrible place for a young man to start a business career in that era, unless you wanted to pick prunes or apricots, because agriculture was basically almost all of the valley's business. So I went 50 miles north to the only larger town nearby in those days, San Francisco, and I went to work for a Fortune 500 company called Crown Zellerbach. They were the second largest paper company in the world, and by the way, they had a very strong relationship with IBM, because they supplied probably about a third of the tabulating card stock on huge rolls, which they shipped to all of those IBM tab card plants around the United States that converted that into tabulating cards. So the facility that I was with at the company headquarters in San Francisco, and I went to work for them actually in less than a year, I think, after that first disk drive was delivered in September of 56. Basically, when we had business guests, I liked to show them around the building, especially after we moved into a marvelous new structure after a year or so. And I always took them up to the top floor to show them how a vice president lived, which is a much more elaborate kind of a facility than any vice president has in this modern era. And and then I'd take them down below the below Market Street, three levels below the street level, to the computer room, and I'd walk them over to this marvelous large machine on one side of the computer room with this heads on these discs moving back and forth and all around. Of the 50 discs, 24-inch discs, by the way, 2 feet in diameter, put on quite a show with this head assembly that Al was mentioning that had to move in and out and up and down. There were only, I think, two heads to be used on all of the 50 discs, so they had to move out and then up and down and put on a very good show. As a person who was later involved actively in the disc drive industry, I have to be amazed that of the dozens of times I took people into that computer room to show off the Remac, it was always working. If you can imagine the mean time between failure that such a thing would have with all of those mechanical parts and the vacuum tubes for electronics and everything, it was really amazing that whenever I took somebody down there, always it was running, which I think was quite an achievement on reliability.
Wow, that's really amazing. So what was the reaction of the people who saw it?
Well, most people were really impressed. They didn't know much about computers, the typical business guest, and there were other computers in the same facility, which you could see just standing there doing nothing except maybe a little motion of the tape drive once in a while. But to see this very large apparatus moving around doing its thing was very impressive. And, of course, it had a glass front on the drive, so you could see all of this going on and see it all in great detail.
Yeah, it sounds interesting. If you think back to that time, could you have imagined the amount of storage that we can store today this quickly, you know, from the invention of the disk drive? Could you even imagine that, or was this so new that you just didn't even think in those terms?
I don't think anybody thought in those terms. A computer was used to just basically add up all of the sales, to keep track of the inventory, to do the payroll for the employees. You didn't have to keep nearly as many records as you do under government requirements today. And, of course, with the available memory online where for random access on a system like that, it was the first one that had only the 5 megabytes. Anything else that you did on the other computers, you had to really load all of that data off a tape drive, typically, for it to be used before it would be available to the computer. So the data that was being addressed for whatever purpose was relatively small by today's terms, and the ways in which the computer was used were much simpler, and as I indicated, employee records, writing the checks, keeping track of inventory, and keeping track of sales. That was basically what most of the mission was of a computer room like that.
Okay, thanks, Jim. Al, let's go back to you. I know you're involved in the Magnetic Disk Heritage Center. Why don't you talk a little bit about that and how somebody might learn more about it?
Essentially, our mission is to preserve the history and legacy of magnetic disk storage at the location where it all began, and that is 99 Notre Dame, San Jose. And the original building, by the way, still exists at that site. The site is now a city landmark. The reason is, from my point of view, magnetic disk storage is, if not the, it certainly is one of the most significant technical innovations that have been made, certainly that have ever been made in the San Jose area. And it's had huge impact as it progressed in terms of the economy here and making it a high-tech region, because IBM built a really major plant for the manufacture of the disk drive and the disk drive systems that came out of that work. Secondly, the local community is not nearly as aware of their heritage as they should be, and that is something that the Heritage Center can address, because the people in San Jose, as in many other areas, should take tremendous pride in what was accomplished here. Now, I'd like to talk about two other aspects of the Heritage Center. First of all, it is, if you ask Jim a question, I'll answer it a little different way. The aerial density on a disk from when I started, and that's going back 50 years until today, is now increased by a factor of 100 million. That in itself is not saying the rest of the story, because it's still maintaining a very active increase in density, which is tremendously expanding the number of applications that people are addressing. So what we want to do is have the origins of the disk drive, and then we want to talk also about some of the major milestones, and more importantly, about some of the societal impact it's having and what it means to people. We want it to be a very educational kind of museum in that context. The other thing, which is my personal thing, is that I see magnetic recording essentially becoming the ways in which essentially all our information is stored and disseminated and exchanged and knowledge is distributed. And the last time we had a major change in social structures due to an information change was going back 500 years to Gutenberg and the movable type printing press. I see magnetic recording as having an equally huge impact as we move forward on the way society does things, and it's moving so quickly, it's hard to know if we can even track it. But I think that's what makes this museum so very special. The Wright brothers are always associated with Kitty Hawk and Powered Flight, and even on the 100th anniversary of that, we spent a lot of time on that topic, and we don't really get preoccupied with jetliners. And I think in the disk storage area, the same thing is true. We have Ray Johnson, 99 Notre Dame, and the Ramac as three things we can embody in the museum we're talking about. And I think we'll find that the basic roots of that are very important, and we'd like to see them better known and preserved, but still focus on where it's all leading and what it means to society.
Okay, thanks, Al. So give us the website.
The website, sjmdhc.org. That will take you to our main website. Now, SJ stands for San Jose, and then Magnetic Disc Heritage Center is the MDHC. The actual website is www.magneticdischeritagecenter.org. And, of course, there are no spaces in that. And it is our link to information that we keep up to date, and we have some information there we've added, and we're also have set up for people who want to make contributions to the Heritage Center. They can find the information there to make it simple for them.
So, Al, thanks. Now, Jim, I understand you're involved with the Computer History Museum, so why don't you tell us a little bit about that and your role in it?
Well, thank you. I've always been a fan of science museums around the world, and have been delighted that the Computer History Museum is settled in Mountain View, which is just a few miles north of San Jose, and they presently have the largest collection of computer artifacts in the world, and they're working to expand their existing what they call visible storage, which impresses everybody who sees it, to the final build-out, which will be done in a few years, and the space which isn't used yet in this new building, with a timeline of the whole computer industry and some special theme rooms on various areas, including storage. I chair the storage committee for the museum, which is one group of ours is putting together a long list of the most significant events in storage which have occurred. Other committees are doing similar things for other areas to guide the museum staff as they work on the build-out to make sure all the most important items are really included in the future displays. We've also been doing videotaped oral histories, and for the videotaped the storage videotape oral history group, of course, has done quite a few, probably more than 20 videotaped oral histories so far, with at least that many to come, covering the significant events, the major product introductions, and that group and its predecessors have done some of covering the things we talked about earlier, which, of course, was the creation of the original Ramac disk drives with its 50 24-inch disks. Many of the people that were involved in that at the beginning participated, and we've asked a lot of the key questions, why, how, when, where, all of those things were done, and the people who did it were there to explain what they were doing and why. So this history is being preserved, and the Computer History Museum, as I indicated, with the largest collection of computer artifacts in the world, is growing that collection at an interesting rate, and in the future will be, I think, on a de facto basis, really the United States Computer History Museum, because nothing else will be even close to it in size or the way in which all of these things are explained to people who come to see it.
Well, Jim, that really sounds fascinating. Do you have a website people could look at?
Yes, the existing website is www.computerhistory, no space between computer and history, .org.
One more thing to remark. Ties in with some comments Jim made earlier as well. The Magnetic Disk Heritage Center has been loaned a RAMAC disk drive by IBM, and we're in the process of restoring it to an operational state so people can really see what a disk drive does by the same things Jim mentioned. That is, they can see the arm go in and out and up and down, and we hope they'll be able to input data and see it stored and retrieve it and really get a feel for how it all started and what the disk drive looked like. And we're working on that restoration project now. We worked on it for 2 years through senior design projects at Santa Clara University. We're now doing it on the next phase, which does the additional engineering needed by volunteers at the Computer History Museum. And that's where we have an office, in fact, where I'm talking to you from right now. So if anyone does visit the Computer History Museum, one of the things, not in visible storage, but in our restoration area, is the RAMAC that's undergoing a renovation to be able to be displayed to the public.
Well, that'll be fascinating. Next time I'm in San Jose, I'll definitely come by and see that. That'll be really great. So let us go ahead and wrap up this podcast. Al and Jim, thanks a lot. This has been a very interesting discussion. And for those listening, I appreciate you taking the time, and check back later for other podcasts that we'll have on this 50th anniversary of DISC System.